Very good to be back at with Unibuzz. Now, is this the first talk of the year? No. This is the first talk of the year, really? Oh, very auspicious. Okay. So, who's new to Unibuzz? Who's new? All right. And who's new to Buddhism? Okay, a few people are new to Buddhism, right? So I'll try not to scare you off. So this is why I've been asked to do a bit of an introductory talk this evening on what is Buddhism, some of the basic teachings and life of the Buddha and these kinds of things. So what is Buddhism? Well, as we start to ask about what is Buddhism, of course we start to get this, it becomes very problematic, because Buddhism is many different things and has been for a long time. So Buddhism has been a major religion for 2,500 years, and for much of that time Buddhism was probably, for the majority of that time, Buddhism was probably the biggest religion in the world. So all over China and east and south as Indonesia, and up to Mongolia, and then west as far as Persia. So this is a massive thing. Buddhism is such a big, broad area. So I won't try to talk too much about Buddhism. But then we have a word we call the Dhamma. Yeah. Now, do you know what Dhamma means? No? Dhamma is the truth. Yeah, that's not a bad understanding, but it's not just any ordinary old truth, is it? Teaching of Buddhism. So Dhamma is the teaching of Buddhism, and it's the truth. Does that mean that only truth is only found in the teachings of Buddhism and not anywhere else?
It's already there, but you have to realize
it. It's already there, but you have to realize it. But what about when you go to maths class? You learn 2 plus 2 equals 4, that's the truth as well. Depends on the context. It might not be true. Or it depends if we get to higher dimensions or something like that, maybe. Yeah.
Like, for example, there was a case in the history of the world. They put two rabbits and another two rabbits in a bag. There was multiple rabbits.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So, so this is one of the things that we try to do, is we want to distinguish between Buddhism, right, and Dhamma. Okay. Now this is something that I learned from, because before I was a Buddhist I was a Christian, I was brought up as a Catholic, and this is one of the things that you learn, is that there's a difference between what maybe the church is teaching us about Jesus and what Jesus' teachings are, yeah, and then what Jesus actually himself said. Okay. And so when we grow up, as we, for myself, as a, from a Catholic background, gradually as you grow up, you begin to realize this, and you begin to realize that there are certain things which are maybe found in Jesus' teachings, which aren't really emphasized by the Christian churches, yeah? And so on. And so we have the same situation in Buddhism, where there are many, many things which go under the name of Buddhism, which don't really have a lot to do with what the Buddha himself said or taught, okay? So we learn to make this distinction between the Dhamma, okay, which is what the Buddha himself taught, and then Buddhism, which is what people have made of that, okay. And so Buddhism really is how do people see Dhamma is very beautiful, and what the Buddha was teaching is very beautiful, very profound, and very very subtle. But people, most people's minds most of the time are not beautiful and profound and subtle, okay? Most of our minds most of the time are fairly ordinary, yeah? And so we can't necessarily cope with the subtlety and the depth of the Buddha's teachings. And so we find ways of adapting it to a level that we can understand and we can relate to. So, So what I like to do is to try to... I'm very interested in in the historic... Excuse my cough, I've just come back from India, and we did a chanting ceremony in Bodh Gaya at the Buddha's enlightenment place. And if any of you have ever been to Bodh Gaya, you'll know that the environment there is not particularly healthy, and a lot of people come down with these coughs and things like that. So I like to look at the historical context of the Buddha. Okay, what was he actually doing? And because we build up this mythology around the Buddha, we have like this idea of Buddha is almost like a god, yeah. But actually, the Buddha was a human being, yeah. And the interesting thing about Buddhism is that it always kind of remembers. Every kind of Buddhism has this memory or has this idea that the Buddha actually is a human being. Yeah, he's a historical human being. His name was Siddhartha Gautama. He was born in the park of Lumbini about 2,500 years ago. We don't know the exact date that he was born, although in fact about the according to the latest estimates by the academics, it would be almost exactly 500 BC that he was born. And he passed away about 420 BC. So he lived for 80 years. And so he was born in a park called Lumbini, okay? And Lumbini now is just over the Nepalese border, okay? So very close to India, but just in the Nepalese side. And you can go there, and they have a very nice park there, and you can go and sit meditation and do some chanting and so on there. And we know that's the Buddha's birthplace? We know that for a very good reason, which is because on the site there's an Ashokan pillar. So have you heard of King Ashoka? Anyone heard of King? Not heard of King Ashoka? No? No? King Ashoka. King Ashoka is very, very important. And we have to say that even though I'm biased, I'm a Buddhist and I'm biased, but of all of the kings and rulers of history, King Ashoka is really the most amazing of them all. Because he started out his reign in India, and he came to the throne about 150 years after the Buddha died. And he inherited an empire which covered much of northern India. And when he came to the throne, he then expanded that with very, very bloody and vicious campaigns. And he invaded the kingdom of Kalinga on the southwest coast of India, killed hundreds of thousands of people, boasted about it. He cut off their heads and stuck them on poles. On the highway leading into the city, so for miles and miles there was just poles with people's heads stuck on them, yeah, to celebrate his victory. And then after a number of years he became converted to Buddhism, and there's this very moving inscriptions that he made where he actually confesses all of the wrongs that he's done, and basically he says sorry, yeah. And so this is the first example I think in history of a politician who was big enough, big-hearted enough to actually say sorry, yeah? And he really had something serious to say sorry for. And so after that he then renounced all violence and then maintained his kingdom. He had a vast kingdom at that time, the biggest kingdom in the world, and the biggest Indian kingdom until the time of the British. And so he then ran the kingdom according to Buddhist principles. So it's a very inspiring story. But one of the things that he did was he erected these pillars, and some of them are still in existence today, and he made inscriptions and pillars. And so this is where we get some of the hard facts that we know about Buddhism. We've learnt from these pillars and inscriptions. And one of them is at Lumbini. And there it says, Iha Buddha He Jate, which means here the Buddha was born. Okay? So that's a pretty good hint. Yeah. that we got this pillar. We know it was not from very long after the Buddha's lifetime, and it was erected on that spot. Iha Buddhe Jate in the Magadhan dialect of the time. So this is where the Buddha was born, in a sal tree grove. His family name was Gotama, he's from the Shakyan clan. Personal name was Siddhartha. His mother's name was Maya. His father's name was Suddhodana. And his family was from... like if you read the legends and stories about Buddhas, it will tell you that he was a king. But actually the Shakyan republic that he was part of was not a kingdom. It was a what you might call an aristocratic republic, which meant it was governed by a committee or rotating committee of the leading clans. Okay, so the aristocratic family, like the landowning families, would have a kind of democratic system. It wasn't fully democratic in the sense that it obviously just included the main, you know, high class landowners, but it was semi-democratic system. And so the Buddha was born into one of those families. And so he lived in the city of Kapilavastu and was brought up there. Now, we don't know very much about the Buddha's early life. One, if we stick to things that are likely to be actual facts, then one thing that's fairly likely is that his mother died shortly after he was born. Okay, and conventionally it says that she died 7 days after he was born. So I think this is very important, and this is a very important item in the Buddha's biography, because, you know, here he's just been born. Now, obviously you've got a very intelligent, very sensitive child, and suddenly, you know, just after you're born, then the first being you form an idea of, an attachment to, of course, is your mother. And so you're just starting to form this idea of your mother, which is like a source of all goodness for you, yeah? A source of food and protection and shelter and love and all of these things. And then suddenly she's not there anymore. Yeah? All of a sudden, boom, she's not there. And so my feeling is that this must have been a very powerful formative influence on the Buddha's mind before he was the Buddha, yeah? That shock or that trauma was one of the things which would have sort of laid seeds of that lay in his mind for many years, yeah? And when he was mature enough to really understand, then that the fruits of that came to be. So then he was brought up. We don't know a huge amount about what happened to him as he was being brought up. One other story seems to be quite have some historical validity and to date from an early time and from the Buddha's own words. And this is quite an interesting episode where he was sitting in a field, sitting underneath a tree, and it was a rose apple tree. And his father was off working, and he was left alone. And as he was sitting there, left alone, he just spontaneously just started watching his breath coming in and out, and went into a deep state of concentration. Now, this deep state of concentration we call the first jhana. Okay, now jhana is a technical word in Buddhist meditation circles. Okay, so if you're going to hang around with Buddhism for a while, you'll hear this word jhana. Okay, and you go jhana, 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 jhana. Everyone talks about it, and you wonder what's jhana. Well, just before we started today, we did some meditation. Okay, so you've all meditated at least once. Okay, that is, unless you were wasting your time while we were sitting there. We've all meditated at least once. So you've got some idea of what meditation is, okay? So meditation is like this kind of withdrawal into the center, okay? And so we gradually bring back our awareness, our sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, okay? All of those things which dominate our experience in everyday life, okay? We gradually draw back from those things, okay? Now, one, part of the logic of meditation is that our mind is one, okay? So the mind actually is here. It's just like one thing. It's unifying. But it's always getting drawn out into these different aspects of experience, okay? So even though the mind is one, it's like it's constantly, things are demanding it, yeah? Just like we're being demanded by mobile phones, yeah? A mobile phone goes off, somehow we have to answer it. We've got an SMS, we've got something, we've got to answer it. And there's this demand, and so this is what our senses are like. So the senses are always alerting us. They're always saying, listen to me, watch me, smell me, taste me, touch me, yeah? And so this is not allowing our mind to be peaceful, okay? So one of the things that we try to do in Buddhism or in meditation is to train our minds to come into that place of stillness and peace in the center, in the heart, okay? Now that doesn't mean that you stay there forever, okay? It doesn't mean you don't see, you don't hear, you don't smell, of course you do all those things still, but there's a time when you set aside those things and you say, now I'm going to meditate, I'm going to come in to the heart, okay? Now, what you'll notice when you're meditating is that, you know, it's quite funny because when you start to meditate, suddenly things which you never worried about before start to become very annoying, okay? So things like a clock ticking in your room, yeah? You've never heard this clock ticking in your room before, yeah? And you come to sit there and meditate and you hear this bang, bang, bang. It's a very loud ticking. Oh my God. In fact, this is very useful because if you ever lose a clock, yeah, or a watch, seriously, the best way to find it is you just go and sit meditation. And when you sit meditation for 5 minutes, you're thinking, oh, there it is. Yeah, it's over there. And so what's happening is that we have this problem at our monastery because we're doing buildings and renovation. And I'm always trying to persuade our builder that we need more sound insulation. And so we'll put more layers on, we need more sound, you know, because and the builders are saying, but is there any, there's no traffic, you're living in the middle of the bush, you know, no one's playing any stereos, you know, you don't have kids running around and yelling and stuff, why do you need it to be so quiet? But if you don't meditate, you don't understand that even those very subtle sounds become very, very much amplified, okay? So what's happening there is that your senses are becoming purified, yeah? And so normally our senses are so stimulated, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, it's stimulating our mind all the time, that the mind becomes like contracted. And so this is just like if you go into a bright space, if you go out into the sunlight and then your eyes contract, yeah? Your pupils contract, so you filter out because you can't stand having all of that energy coming in, okay? So this is what our mind does. When we have a lot of sense input, our mind closes down. It has to reject it. It can't tolerate that sense input anymore. And so this is why you get onto that, like a spiral where the input has to become more and more and more and more. So the volume has to go up and up and up and up. And you have to have more and more input in order to get the same kind of response. So in meditation, we try to undo that spiral, okay? And so we reduce the amount of sensory input for a period of time. We have a place that's nice and quiet, not too bright. We sit and we bring our mind inwards. And as you do that, the senses gradually become purified, and they become more sensitive. And gradually you start to go beyond the senses, okay? And so you're coming inside, 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 and you're starting to be aware of the mind itself, okay? You start to be able to reflect or like look as if looking in a mirror, okay? So as if the mind is just looking at itself in a mirror. Now this is a very... Once we start to get into this realm, it becomes difficult to talk about because we always have to speak in terms of metaphors because it's not the kind of experience that we directly have in everyday life, that we have a language that we can share, okay? So we have to use metaphors. And so it's as if the mind is looking at itself in the mirror, okay? And so when the mind does this, it goes into that, it becomes purified, becomes very bright, okay? And so you have these qualities of the mind at that kind of stage. It feels very bright, like there's a bright light in the mind. It feels very blissful, okay? It feels very peaceful, very centered, very grounded, okay? Now, if you continue that process, deepening, 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 eventually you'll come to a place where all the sense activity stops completely, okay? So it's not just that the sense activity is more subtle and more refined, but it completely stops. And so the mind just doesn't engage with the external senses at all and goes completely within itself, okay? And at that point, this is what we call the first jhana, okay? So the first jhana is that point where the mind has completely withdrawn from any sense activity and is very still and content within itself. Okay? Now this is a very subtle state of mind. Many of us can meditate for many years even without experiencing this kind of thing. So don't worry if you practice for a while or do a retreat and you don't get anything like that. We don't talk about these things in order to make you feel inadequate, okay? This is not the purpose of talking about it. We talk about it so that you understand, oh, okay, this is what meditation is about, okay? Now that experience of first jhana is not an enlightenment experience, okay? It's just a state of mind, that's all. It's a state of purified consciousness. You go in there, stay for a while, you come out again, and gradually the mind will return to normal, okay? So it's not a state of enlightenment, but it's part of the path on the way to enlightenment. Okay, so it's very important that we understand these things. So this experience of jhana is not in any sense confined to Buddhism. And it's well acknowledged throughout all the history of Buddhism that there are saints or mystics or meditators from any different kind of religious tradition or spiritual tradition who will also realize these kinds of things, okay? And if you look at the writings of the mystics in the Christian traditions or the Hindu traditions or the Sufi traditions and so on, then they will describe similar kinds of states of mind, okay? And it seems that, coming back to the story of the Buddha's early life, it seems that when he was sitting under the jumbo tree, under the rose apple tree, that he spontaneously went into some kind of state of mind like this, okay? And this also, I think, is very realistic. I don't think this is at all impossible. And I think, in fact, it's not at all implausible that children, the minds are very fresh, yeah, very spontaneous, should be able to sometimes go into these states of mind, okay? I'm not saying that all children will do, but I'm saying that I think it is possible. And I've heard stories from friends of mine who one friend of mine in in Malaysia, who the first time he sat to meditate went into the first jhana just almost by accident. He couldn't do it again after that, yeah? After that he was just sitting there thinking and expecting and pain and everything. But that first time something happens, and then you can kind of slip into it. So I think this is quite plausible that this actually happened. But because he was only a little boy, it didn't mean anything. He couldn't take it anywhere. It was just something that happened to him, and then he went on with life. So that's all we hear about that episode for now. Later on, then of course he grew up, he got married, he had his wife, Yashodhara, and he had a son called Rahula, and so there's many stories about the episode that prompted him to go forth, and in my opinion, most of those stories date from a slightly later time than the very earliest period of the Buddhist scriptures, And if we look at the passage which seems to me to be the most authentic is actually the least known, and this is a sutta called the Atadanda Sutta in the Sutta Nikaya. And in that it's very simple, and it just says that the interesting thing that it says about his going forth, why did he go forth? He said it was because of conflict. He said he saw people everywhere opposing each other, yeah, and it was violence. And he described he felt like a fish flopping around in a dried up bed of a stream, yeah. And he looked in every direction and couldn't find a place of safety. Yeah, everywhere he looked, he could see this instability, shaking, like the world was trembling everywhere he looked, and he couldn't see any place of safety. And this is what prompted him to find that place where he wouldn't have to keep on running around. And so he looked and he said, well, what is that? What is that thing that is nestling in the heart? So he uses the word hadayanisitam, nestling in the heart, that stops us from being peaceful. What is that thing that causes us to have conflict and violence against each other? And then he saw that what that thing was what he called craving. Okay. And so here we come to an understanding of what the Buddha talked about the Four Noble Truths. And I'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on. But for now, he went forth, and age 29. Okay. Of course, that act of going forth was quite well established in ancient India at that time. There were many, as there were in India today, there was many kind of ascetics and sadhus and, you know, seekers of many kinds that would go out and practice in the forests or the mountains and so on. And they are very, it's a very diverse kind of community, you know. And in the time of the Buddha, you know, you had these naked ascetics wandering around the place. You had these people doing these incredible kinds of self-torment. So they'd like stand on one leg for years at a time and all of these kinds of things. And it's really quite amazing, you know, like, you know, you have these ascetics who just stand up and have one arm in the air for like 10 years at a time until their arm becomes all withered and useless and so on. Yeah? And but they're regarded as wimps, all right, because you've still got one hand that you can use. So the really tough ones have both hands in the air. Okay. Now you think about it. You've got both hands in the air, right? There's not a lot you can do with your both hands in the air. And so so the Buddha went forth for a while and practiced with these kinds of ascetics and went and explored the different schools and teachings and things that were available at the time. And he studied with some that were doing very deep kind of meditation. And then he went and did all these kinds of self-torment. He tortured himself. He fasted till he was almost dead. And you'll still see sometimes the images of the Buddha, the fasting Buddha, and all these kind of ribs sticking out and all of these kinds of, he's not really a Buddha, he's a bodhisattva at that time. So this is what we call a bodhisattva. So bodhisattva is one who's striving for enlightenment. Okay. So at this stage we call Siddhartha the bodhisattva. And didn't get anywhere, and he realized at the end of all of this time that it was all a waste of time and he hadn't accomplished anything. Okay. And so then it was at that point, it was this crucial juncture in his practice. So up until now he'd been relying on the teachings and the advice that he'd received from various kinds of schools at the time, and none of that was adequate for him. He wanted to find and it's a beautiful sutta called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. He's in the Majjhima Nikaya. He's wanted to find how can I find that which is beyond birth, aging and death? Yeah? This was the question that he was asking. He wasn't interested in just merely living a happy and contented life. Okay? So he wasn't just after like a kind of psychological happiness. Yeah? So this is where the Buddha's teachings start to become very challenging, yeah? Because we can when we read about Buddhism, often these days when people try to sell Buddhism and you have these conferences and it's like happiness and so on and so forth and everything's happy, 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 yeah? But in the end, happiness is just a state of mind, okay? So happiness is good, yeah? And so we have Buddhist techniques that are very successful and very useful for helping us to be happy, right? But in the end, happiness is not the goal. Okay, happiness is just a state of mind. What's beyond that? And traditionally, in most religions or many religions, they think of the goal of their religion is something like rebirth in heaven. Okay, so you die, you want to get reborn in heaven, and then you live in the company of God or however you want to conceive the heaven. And again, the Buddha wasn't happy with that. Okay, he wasn't content because anytime you get reborn, there's birth, there's aging and death, and so he saw these things always come together. So whatever state of being that you're in, it's always going to be unsatisfactory. Okay? And so this is where the teachings of Buddhism start to get very deep and very challenging. So he wanted to get something that was completely beyond all of those things. Okay? Then, at that point, he recollected that experience that he'd had as a child, the experience of first jhana. He remembered that experience. And then he thought, why should I be afraid of that happiness? Here I am, I've been trying to torture myself, I've been trying to torment my body, starve myself to get enlightened. But why am I afraid of that happiness? Because there was nothing unwholesome about that happiness. It was very pure. It was just a very still, very pure happiness. Why am I afraid of that? He said, there's nothing to be afraid of. Perhaps that... And so in the sutta itself, it has this the way I should explain when I say a sutta is a discourse of the Buddha. And so these are collected in the collections of the earliest scriptures we have of Buddhism. And so in this sutta, there's perhaps, maybe that could be the way to enlightenment. Okay? And then the answer comes, it's like an intuition. So the intuition arises to him, eso va mago bodhaya. That indeed is the way to enlightenment. Okay? And so then he says, okay, to do that kind of meditation, I can't do it if I'm too frail and too ill. So I've got to get something to eat. So that's the good news. Alright? So if your body is too emaciated and famished, you can't meditate properly. So you need to have a harmony. Your body needs to be healthy and strong. Yeah? And so then he had something to eat and he went to a place called Bodh Gaya. And this is where I've just been for the last few weeks and doing a chanting ceremony. So Bodh Gaya is just in the state of Bihar in central India, just south of the Ganges River. And there's a very large and very beautiful temple that's built on the site. And the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree. So if you can't go very far in Buddhism without hearing about the Bodhi tree, yeah? So the Bodhi tree is Bodhi means enlightenment, and the Bodhi tree is the tree the Buddha sat under to get enlightened, okay? And so this is, the Bodhi tree actually is a very beautiful, very large tree, fig tree, and it's quite widely worshipped as a religious tree in India, long, long time before the Buddha. And that was kind of, actually probably it was already a shrine. So in ancient Indian religion, and still in India today, they often would make a little shrine to the local deities around the village. And so they would make a little shrine there, clear up the jungle, and then make some little offerings and so on. So it was probably something like that that the Buddha was sitting at when he went to go and get enlightened. So he sat down there. And he made the determination, I'm not going to get up from this seat until I realize full enlightenment. Okay? Now, a lot of people have done that since then, and it hasn't necessarily worked. Okay? So, you have to have the conditions have to be right. Yeah? You can't just force yourself to get enlightened. Okay? He was ready for it. Okay, he'd done all those years of practice and preparation. He was ready for it. So, he goes to sit under the Bodhi tree. Now, we have quite a lot of different accounts of what happened under the Bodhi tree. Okay, each one is complementary. They all present the same kinds of events from a slightly different perspective. Okay. And so this is where we come to that, again, that concept that we talked about a little bit before, the Dhamma. Okay? So the word Dhamma, we say in Pali language, is Dhamma. In Sanskrit, we say Dharma. Dharma, or Dhamma, is the truth which the Buddha realized. Okay? In Buddhist context, okay? This is a simple way of understanding it. Used in different... Indian religions all use the word Dhamma, but they use it sometimes in different meanings. So we say that the Buddha realized the Dhamma underneath the Bodhi tree. Okay? Now that Dhamma which he realized can then be expressed in many ways. Okay? Can be expressed in, from different points of view. Okay? Now that expression is also called the Dhamma. Okay? So the actual written teaching, the textual teaching, we also call Dhamma. But it's important to realize that that's Dhamma in a very different sense than the actual Dhamma of realization. Yeah? The Dhamma of realization is the real thing. Yeah? And that's actually what you see, that's the actual truth. You then try to describe that, and you always lose something when you try to describe it. Yeah? The description of something is never as beautiful as the thing itself. Yeah? You can try to describe what does a sunset look like. Yeah? And even the greatest poet can never describe a sunset to make it as beautiful as the real thing. So we always have to bear that in mind when we're looking at the Dhamma, is that no matter how beautiful the teachings are, okay, they're always limited. So we can never really grasp the truth of it just through the teachings themselves. Okay? They're just a pointer. So we try to understand what actually happened when the Buddha got enlightened. We use this word enlightened. Or awakened. The word Bodhi more literally means awakening. But what really happened? It's very, very difficult for us to know that. Yeah? He uses all of these words. He says light arose, vision arose, knowledge arose, yeah? Realization arose. Yeah? And so in a sense there was this deep level intuition into the truth. And that truth, we can try to approach that from a number of different directions. But what I might just come back to that in a moment with the Buddha's first teaching how he himself tried to express the truth when he first tried to communicate that. Now, on that morning, he sat meditation all night. Yeah, so this is very nice. I really like that. It's a really nice metaphor because normally, you know, daytime is the light, yeah, and then nighttime is the unconscious. Yeah? We don't know what's going on at nighttime, but it's the time of the unconscious. So he sort of sat up all through the night and like illuminated, yeah, all of those things which are normally darkness. Yeah, the ignorance in the mind is normally darkness. It was all illuminated by the Buddha. And so even today, meditators like to sit up late at night, and sometimes to sit up all night meditating. Yeah, so if you get the chance to do that, it's a very lovely thing to do. And when the dawn broke that morning, he was a Buddha. So before that point, we shouldn't really refer to him as a Buddha. He was a Bodhisattva. He was seeking enlightenment. And at that point, he becomes a Buddha. He's fully enlightened. So after his enlightenment or his awakening, he wanted to teach. He wanted to share what he knew with others. And so he thought he would go to Benares. It's a city about a couple of hundred kilometers to the west of Bodh Gaya, and there was a group of five monks were staying there. Now what had happened was, when before his enlightenment, he was staying with this group of five monks, and they were all doing these really tough ascetic practices and trying to starve themselves to death, basically. And when he started eating some food, these five monks then rejected him. Okay, they said, "Oh, he's reverted to luxury. Okay, he's a backslider." Right? He's gone soft, so we're giving up on him. So they left and they went off to Benares. So he said, okay, well, I'll go and teach them. So he went to see them again. And when he came up and they saw them, they said, here comes that backslider Gotama. Yeah, he's reverted to luxury. No way could he have got anything. We won't even go and greet him. If he wants to come here, let him come. He can just sit down wherever he likes, but we're not going to go and receive him or anything like that. But when he came, they couldn't help themselves. Yeah, one of them went out and they made Anjali and they took his bowl. Another one came, they washed his feet and they prepared a seat for him. They couldn't keep the agreement that they'd made. There was something about him, yeah, which had changed. And even though on an intellectual level they still were kind of rejecting him, but actually intuitively they could see that there is something about him which was different. They couldn't put their finger on it. So then he sat down and tried to teach them. And they wouldn't listen to his teaching at first. They said, "No, you're a backslider. We're not going to listen to you." And he said, "Monks," he said, "I'm not a backslider, okay? I haven't given up practicing. I've seen the Dhamma. Listen, I can show you, I can help you to find the way to the Dhamma." And eventually he was able to persuade them. And so then he taught a very famous discourse, which we call the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first teaching, the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma. And it's a very, very powerful discourse. And in there he taught two essential teachings, okay, which I'll just summarize for you very briefly now. First one which he taught was the Noble Eightfold Path, okay? And this is he described this Noble Eightfold Path as the middle way. Alright? So when you hear in Buddhism, very often people talk about the middle way and practicing the middle way. Well, the middle way is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? And the reason it's the middle way is because it steers between or avoids these two extremes. So the middle way doesn't mean the average way. Okay, this is very important. It doesn't mean the mediocre way, right? It doesn't mean the way that's just kind of good enough, right? It doesn't mean the lukewarm way, right? It means the way that doesn't have anything to do with the extremes. Now, we can characterize the extremes in different ways, and in the Buddha's discourses he talked about the extremes in different ways in different contexts. But in this particular context, the two extremes were the two ways of life which the Buddha himself had practiced before his enlightenment. One of which was living in the palace and living a very indulgent life, and then the other one was the extremes of self-mortification, trying to torture his body. Okay, so these were the two extremes which he had, and the middle way avoids those two extremes. So the middle way, eight factors, right? Who knows the eight factors? Any guess? What's the first one?
Good concentration.
Good concentration. Mm, you need to concentrate more.
Training the mind, ethics, and wisdom.
Training the mind, ethics, and wisdom.
Yeah. And then training the mind and mindfulness.
But what's the first factor of the Eightfold Path?
First factor,
right livelihood.
Right
view. Right view, okay, very good. Well, you've got to get there eventually. So the first factor is right view, that's very good. So right view initially and very simply means just having an accurate, useful idea and theory and a conceptual idea of what the path is and what the Dhamma is. Okay? So initially it doesn't mean anything particularly profound. Okay? It's important to notice that. So right view is what we are all trying to develop here. Okay? Listening to the teaching, discussing it among ourselves, reading, okay? This is how we develop our right view. Okay? Second factor is right thought. Okay, very good. Sammasankappa. So right thought is thoughts of letting go. Okay, so instead of thoughts of accumulating lots of things, is thoughts of letting them go. Alright? Yeah, so instead of thoughts of getting, is thoughts of giving. Yeah, this is one of them. Thoughts of kindness, is right thought. Thoughts of loving kindness. Thoughts of non-harming. Okay, so this is like using your mind in a wholesome way. So not using your mind in a way that's trying to exploit and use others. And nor using it to harm anybody or any being. Okay, so it's right thought. Next one.
Concentration.
Right speech. Right speech. Okay, very good. Okay, so right speech means not lying and slandering and backbiting and basically using speech in any way that's going to be harmful. Okay? So the right speech. Next one. Right action, which is?
Smiling.
Smiling goes with all of them. You do all of them, you smile.
Not killing.
Yep. Sexual misconduct. Yeah. So basically keeping all those kind of precepts. So again, that means, what that means is like doing acts of the body which are going to be causing harm to others. Alright? Again, we can't go into all of these things in very much detail, but most of them are pretty straightforward. As far as killing, then of course in Buddhism then it includes killing animals, insects, right? Mosquitoes, flies, yeah? All of these as part of living beings. So we see in Buddhism we have the idea of rebirth, okay? So we believe that we've been born before countless times, okay? And so that mosquito has been your mother in the past life. It's been your sister, your brother, yeah? In your past life. It's been your best friend. So are you going to kill it? So it's not killing, not stealing. Fairly obvious. So we should be very honest with everything that we have around us and not cheating on tax returns and all of these kinds of things. And sexual misconduct. Basically, the sexual misconduct means that not betraying the trust that you have with another person. Because when you enter into a sexual relationship with somebody, then it's very intimate and there's a lot of trust, mutual trust, that's involved in that. Yeah? And so betraying that, however that may be, causes a huge amount of pain and suffering. Yeah? So we've all been through that. We all know what that means. So having that sense of integrity and mutual respect, okay, when we're in relationships with people, is what that's about. Okay, so then next one. What's the next one? No.
Livelihood.
Right, livelihood. Okay. So, and what's right livelihood? Intoxicants. Not selling intoxicants, you mean? Using them. Yeah, that comes under the right action precept, but also not selling them comes under the right livelihood as well. Yeah. So making your livelihood in any kind of way that causes harm to others. So for example, if you're selling cigarettes or drugs or something like that, selling weapons.
Advertising.
Well, that's a very interesting one. Yeah. Is that right livelihood or not? You're going to go to hell for being a PR executive. Those things are very interesting, and it is quite interesting because our world, in that respect, our world has changed a lot since the time of the Buddha. So the kinds of wrong livelihood which the Buddha mentioned, like slavery, you know, making a living from selling human beings or even selling animals and so on. Okay, so those still go on, and we can recognize that this is wrong livelihood. But there are many, many other kinds of jobs which are available to us today, which a lot of them are in this kind of grey area, and advertising, you know, is one of those. And it's the way you think, well, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with, you know, making an ad to tell people that there is this product and so on and so forth. And there are degrees of integrity which you can do that, all the way from being an outright lie to, you know, simply presenting the information about the product. Yeah. So there are different levels of integrity about that. But I think that in that particular case, one thing would be, if you're going to do it, then you know you need to maintain that sense of integrity. Whether you can actually do that in the advertising world, I don't know. I haven't lived in that world. I have my doubts. But
there's companies that actually say we're not sure, and they realize,
right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, there are many, many dubious things going on in that world. So, I mean, one thing you can think of is to try to aspire to a really good kind of livelihood, okay? So there are certain kinds of ways that you can live that are going to be really useful. So, for example, being a doctor, yeah? Being a teacher, yeah? Any kind of livelihood which is even just doing something which is of you know, just ordinary benefit for people. So even just being a builder, yeah, is a kind of right livelihood because you're providing homes for people to live in. Yeah, these things are very simple. But you know, you can also think about, you know, you're going to do some more socially orientated work. So maybe if you're studying law, you know, when you do that, you can make those choices. Yeah, you can think, well, I'm going to go into corporate law and I'm going to get into this big high finance thing and I'm going to make lots of money. Or you could say, well, I'm going to get into human rights law and I'm actually going to try to do something to make the world a more fair and equitable place. Yeah? So that's that choice that you can make. So this is what right livelihood is about. It's about saying, well, how do we live it? Because, you know, in a way, in Buddhism, we talk about meditation all the time, but, you know, how long a day do you spend meditating? You spend half an hour a day or an hour a day meditating, but you spend 8 hours a day at work. Yeah? And so that 8 hours a day is also a very, very important part of your spiritual development. Yeah? So this is right livelihood, very important. Okay, so right, next one, right effort. Okay, so that means that according to Buddhism, that anything good only comes from your own effort. Okay, so you have to strive for things, they don't come automatically. Alright, and so this part of that means is that there's no saviour. Alright, so Buddhism doesn't have a saviour. Buddha said, I can't save you. Alright, very straightforward. I can't save you, you have to save yourself. So this is where you need to have that effort. Next one, right mindfulness. Okay, now right mindfulness is a very, very interesting one, very important. And mindfulness has become very popular these days. You know, you have it's taught a lot for various kinds of mental illness and things like that. And in fact, right mindfulness is now, I learned a little while ago, has now become, as a result of, they did a massive test in England for the NHS, the National Health Service in England, to determine what's the most effective treatment for depression. Okay, and so they tested drug therapy, what they call cognitive behavioural therapy, which is basically right thought. Yeah, it's the second factor of the Eightfold Path, is learning to think in a better, more healthier way. And then the last one they tested was mindfulness-based therapy. And they found out that of those three, that by far the most effective and by far the most cost-effective was the mindfulness-based treatment. Yeah? And it's much more effective than any drug-based treatment. So this has now become very, very mainstream in our health and therapeutic world. And so essentially mindfulness means being in the moment and being with whatever you're doing. Okay, so there's that sense of bringing the mind into here and now. So the word mindfulness itself is very suggestive, being full of mind. Yeah? And so we can learn to practice this in just everyday things. So when we're picking up things, do we just be with that feeling, if you can feel the sensation, the hardness of this, and bringing that sense of awareness to it. And so that we're not, mindfulness is a practice of like direct awareness and bare awareness rather than thinking and analysing about things. Okay? So from a Western philosophical background, or scientific background, we always want to try to analyse and think about things. But from a Buddhist point of view, that's only part of the story. Okay, so thinking and analysing it is only part of the story. That's under the right view section of the path, okay, that we do that. Now we're under the right mindfulness section of the path. We're not thinking about that. We're experiencing it. Okay? And so we learn to experience that, and especially we learn to experience that through meditation. Okay? And that's where this will start to become much more refined and become much deeper. And so the basic practices of right mindfulness in meditation, effectively what that means is picking up and focusing on a particular kind of what we call a meditation object. Okay, So over the course of this year in Unibuds, I'm sure they have many different meditation teachers coming, and they'll all teach a particular meditation object. So some might teach, like we did earlier, loving kindness. Okay? And so this is a way that you use to establish your mindfulness on that thought of loving kindness and on that feeling of loving kindness. Another kind of meditation would be, for example, breath meditation, where you're focusing on the feeling of the air coming in and out of your nostrils as you're sitting there breathing. Okay? This is another kind of meditation. So then there are many different kinds. All of these are ways of establishing your mindfulness and for getting a continuity. The point of this is to get a continuity and a stability of awareness in the present moment. Okay? This is what we call right mindfulness. When you can do that, the right mindfulness is established, then it moves on to the last section of the Eightfold Path we call right samadhi. So right samadhi is just a synonym for what we call jhana. I spoke about jhana a little bit earlier in the context of the Buddha's life. So this right mindfulness leads on to right samadhi, so that when you focus on the breath, the mind becomes very peaceful, and then eventually it withdraws inside itself. And this we call right samadhi, the various stages of jhana. So we normally talk about four jhanas. And there are various other states of concentration which can be included there as well. So all of these things taken together, we call the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? And so as Buddhist practitioners, we should try to do all of these things. Okay? Practice all of these things. Not just one or the other, all of them. And when we practice all of those things to a sufficient degree, okay, deeply enough, and we can't say how much is sufficient, how much is enough, it depends on the individual. When we do that, then, when they all come together, we have that what we call a vision of the Dhamma, okay, the Dhamma Chakku, the eye of the Dhamma, okay, so we see the truth. Right? And so that brings us to the second thing which the Buddha taught in his first sermon, which is the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path leading to the ending of suffering. Now, once I was looking at it, there was a book of quotations, and it was like the world's greatest quotations. And so I looked in that, and I thought, well, what's the greatest quotation that under the Buddha? What does it have? And so I looked under there, and it had the Buddha's great thought was there is suffering, and there is an origin of suffering. That's all it had. Yeah. And I thought, that wasn't maybe I wouldn't call that such a great thought. It's kind of fairly average thought, actually. But Four Noble Truths, yeah? Ending of suffering and the way leading to the ending of suffering. So sometimes Buddhism is criticized for being very negative. Okay, so suffering, suffering, suffering. You're always talking about suffering. So the important point we're there to remember is that if you want to put it in philosophical terms, you could say that Buddhism is existentially negative, but is psychologically positive. Okay? So the state of mind that we try to develop, yeah, is a state of mind of happiness. It's a very positive state of mind. Yeah? When we have that very positive state of mind, then we are able to realize and to see the true depth of what the Buddha meant by talking about suffering. Okay? If we're not ready for it, if we haven't developed all those factors of the Eightfold Path, then we won't be able to really see it and really understand it. So remember that the Buddha did not teach these Four Noble Truths in order to make us feel depressed. Right? This is not Buddhism. He taught us in order to make us free. Okay? Because being in Buddhism and in Indian religions, being free is much better than being happy. Yeah? Happiness is something contingent. Okay? Happiness is something dependent. The Buddha wanted something that's not dependent, okay? Something that's free. And so our goal is freedom. Happiness is part of the path to that freedom. So when the Buddha talked about when the Buddha talked about suffering, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, and so on and so forth. Now, as it happens, I have a little snippet here that I got from the newspaper the other day about that. Birth is suffering. Right, now this is true. Right, here you go, it's from the paper. The title of this is Pregnant Woman Uses Train Toilet, Baby Slips Out. Right? So here's the article. A newborn baby girl survived an ignoble birth after slipping down the toilet bowl of a moving Indian train onto the tracks when a pregnant woman unexpectedly gave birth while relieving herself on Tuesday. My delivery was so sudden, she said. I did not even realize that my child had slipped from the hole in the toilet. So she's a 33-year-old woman. The child was born 2 months premature. She fainted on the toilet seat after the birth for a few minutes before waking up and alerting her family. So you can imagine the scene on the train. Oh my God, I had a baby! I dropped the baby down the toilet. Yeah, that's the technical detail which is not addressed in the scientific.
Thank God.
The mind boggles, yeah. They stopped the train and ran on the tracks to find the baby, she said, speaking from a hospital bed in the western city of Ahmedabad. Railway staff at a nearby station were alerted and soon found the newborn girl lying uninjured on pebbles by the track. Maybe she bounced. And it says, the final comment it says here is, most toilets on Indian trains are filthy chutes emptying directly onto the tracks. So
the way for
the yeah, I don't know. This is for a picture.
No, that's not me, that's the
truth. Yeah. Yeah. Newborn babies are actually very resilient because they're very, let's say, bounced. They don't even. Their bones aren't formed and stuff. So they can actually. I don't know, but anyway, it's a good illustration of this idea that birth is suffering, isn't it? You know? And when you think about that, it's actually like all of our births are like that in a way, yeah? Really, isn't it? You know, there we are, one moment we're sitting in the womb, we're thinking, you know, life's pretty rosy, and then all of a sudden, there you are, boom, you're in the middle of everything, and then, you're ejected into this world which you've got no comprehension of, and deal with it, that's all, you know? There's no like, excuse me, I'd like to go back. I didn't ask for this. No, can I have another one, please? No, that's it. You're just there, and you just have to deal with it. And sometimes there you are. You're lying on the railway train tracks of life, right? On the pebbles, there's a train roaring above you. And what do you do? Yeah? You just have to deal with it. So this is birth and suffering. Yeah? So. Of course, when the Buddha was talking about these things, he wasn't saying that birth and all the rest of life is only suffering and it's kind of unrelieved pain and agony and that there's nothing else. Okay, this is not what he was saying. What he was saying was that even in happiness, yeah, there's not perfection. There's not a perfection of suffering. And this is for many reasons, but one of the main reasons is because of impermanence. Yeah? Even those most beautiful thing that you might have is still impermanent. Yeah? And so this is very interesting. The Buddha said that this is one of the differences between an enlightened being, somebody who's seen the Dhamma and somebody who doesn't. That when somebody who sees the Dhamma, who understands the Dhamma, maybe will receive something beautiful. Maybe someone gives them a gift. Yeah. So somebody who doesn't understand the Dhamma will be enraptured by that. They'll be caught up with it. They'll be attached to it. And somebody who sees the Dhamma will reflect about it. Yeah? This is very beautiful now. It's very nice. It's very shiny. But this is impermanent. One time, the teacher of my lineage, Ajahn Chah, somebody asked him, Ajahn Chah, what's right view? And he just picked up it and said, this cup is broken. This is right view. The cup is broken. Yeah. This is very beautiful teaching, because we might say that the cup now is not broken, but its nature is to break. Yeah? The nature of the cup is to break. It's just a matter of time. Yeah? Whether it's whole or whether it's broken, it's just a matter of time. And so we look at it, and we tend to get enraptured with what is, yeah? And we get caught up in that. But a broader perspective sees, well, all of these things have the nature to perish. Yeah? And so the way that enlightenment experience is expressed in the Buddha's first sermon, Yang Kinchi Samudaya Dhamman Sabantan Yorodha Dhamman, whatever is of the nature to arise, whatever is of the nature to come to be, also has the nature to cease. Yeah? That's all. So these things are very, very simple insights, but they're something which you can never go beyond, in a sense. Yeah? No matter how much you want to look into physics or science or anything like that, you always come back to the same truth. It's always looking at impermanence. Whatever comes to be must cease. And so this, by seeing this, then you find freedom. Okay? Now the second noble truth is the truth of the origin of suffering. And the truth of the origin of suffering is basically that, as I mentioned before, craving and attachment and ignorance and desire and anger and hatred and all of these kinds of things. It's all this inner stuff which is causing our suffering. Okay? In other words, we can't blame the government. Right? We can't blame our parents. Yeah? We can't blame George Bush. Right? We can't blame the terrorists. Yeah? You can't, because we always want to blame somebody else. Yeah? It's always looking out at somebody, it's their fault. We're always trying to blame somebody else. Suffering comes from within. Okay? And so this is a very, very deep truth which the Buddha pointed to. So when we see that, then we can own our own suffering. We take responsibility for it. So Buddhism is a very adult religion. Okay? It's a very mature religion. Okay? We are responsible for our own existential situation. We're responsible for our own life. We're responsible for our own suffering, and only we can fix that. Nobody else can fix it for us. Okay? So this is the third noble truth, is letting go. Okay? When we learn to let go, okay, then we don't suffer. Okay? When we don't identify with things, we don't regard them as me or mine. We don't want them, we don't crave them, we don't try to reject them and send them away. Okay? But we have that attitude of equanimity, contentment. Okay? And so, you know, we kind of enlightenment. Life goes on. You know? You still get up in the morning, you go to the toilet, you know, you have your breakfast. All of those things happen, yeah? But you don't get so involved in it. And this is something that you'll start to see even at a very preliminary stage, even just through doing a little bit of meditation, you'll start to experience that. For example, you know, you'll see very simple things where when you're sitting meditation, and this is a universal experience, all meditators will have, you're sitting meditation, a certain pain comes up, maybe an itch, okay? An itch comes up, and it's the most annoying itch. You're sitting there thinking, oh, I'm not going to scratch it. And normally you never notice itches because we're not mindful. Itch comes up, we just scratch it, we don't think about it, yeah? You're sitting there and it's the most demanding thing. We have to scratch it. We must scratch that itch. But then we don't. We just sit there and we resist it after a while. And then after a while, your mind lets go, yeah? And the itch goes away. Yeah? And you can see, what you start to notice is that you can see that relationship between the physical pain and your mental attachment. Okay, sometimes the physical pain, it seems like the physical pain goes first, and then you feel, oh, okay, relieved now, they've gone away. But other cases, you see very clearly that the pain is still there, but the mind lets go of it. Okay? The pain is still there, the mind lets go of it, and then it doesn't bother you anymore. And then what you'll notice after that, after a few minutes, that the pain itself will go away. Okay? And then we start to realize, oh, actually, it's the mind that's cooking these things up. Yeah? And these things we're experiencing in our body are actually manifestations of tensions and so on within our own mind. Yeah? And when we let go, and that letting go happens just at an intuitive level. It doesn't happen because you're telling yourself to let go. Okay? Okay, you can't sit there and say, free your mind, free your mind, free your mind. Doesn't work. But when you prepare your mind in the right way, it will let go by itself. And so then that preparing the mind in the right way is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, and that's just the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay? So that means all of those things we mentioned before in the Eightfold Path, this is what prepares your mind for letting go and for finding peace. So this was the content of the Buddha's first sermon that the Buddha taught to the first five monks, five ascetics, and when he taught that, one of the monks, Anyakondanya, realized the truth, he saw the truth. So that was the first time that we had somebody who, apart from the Buddha himself, who had seen the truth in our time, in our generation. So just to round off the talk very briefly, after that then the Buddha kept on teaching for 45 years. At that time he was 35 years old when he started teaching, and he kept on teaching for 45 years, and during that time he established a what we call a Sangha, monastic community of both monks and nuns, and established a way of living, lifestyle, conduct, which governs how the communities live, and those communities are still in existence today. And he also established and converted a large number of lay followers throughout many of the cities in India. And when he was 80, he went to a place called Kusinara, and there he very peacefully passed away, lying between two sal trees. Again, Kusinara, if you know where that is, you can go and visit it. And you know, when you, very nice to visit these places, because you realize that the Buddha actually is, or was, a real human being. This is actually where he stepped, this is where he was born, this is where he sat in meditation, this is where he taught, this is where he attained final nirvana. And so this is my little talk for you this evening. Don't want to take up too much time. We're nearly at the end, nearly 9 o'clock. So maybe open up if anyone has any questions before we finish, or comments, or if anyone wants to refute any of my doctrines.
Please go easy on me, I'm new.
Yep.
I know you haven't touched much on the idea of the translation of souls and so on.
Yep.
I'm curious, that idea, that whole concept, is that originated with the Buddha, or was that around on the planet before?
That's a very good question, and it's not as obvious as you might think. So just to take the question apart little bit by little bit, first thing is that ideas about rebirth, okay, that you can be born in different states, or that people can be born again and so on, are very common. Okay, and we know that from anthropological studies, they're actually found very widely spread among peoples all over the world. Okay, so that's one fact. Second thing is that there is a unique complex of ideas associated with rebirth that is peculiar to ancient to India, the Indian cultural sphere, and also is found in the Greek philosophers, Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and a few others, and is not found anywhere else, okay? Which is quite interesting. And that complex of ideas basically says that we are reborn, rebirth happens without end, so we don't have a limited number of rebirths, okay? We keep on getting reborn, and that rebirth is generated by what we call karma, which means it's generated by our ethical choices, okay? So this is what karma means. Okay, so when we're thinking about karma in Buddhism, we need to set aside these ideas we have that karma means fate. Okay, karma doesn't mean fate. Karma means what is our ethical choice. And so this is like the engine that drives rebirth. Okay, and the last point, which is found within this complex of ideas, is that true liberation consists of stepping outside of that whole cycle. Okay, so that's a complex of ideas which is present in several major Indian religions today, including Buddhism. Okay? Now, in the time of the Buddha, these ideas were much debated. Okay? So it was not the case it was the case that those ideas were around, okay, but it was not the case that they were universally accepted by all the religions, okay? Some accepted them, some didn't, and there was a lot of debate about it, okay? So the Buddha was one of those, Buddhism was one of those groups that accepted the idea of rebirth, okay? But the Buddha said that he didn't teach about rebirth because he inherited the idea from some other teacher. He said he taught about it because it was what he saw for himself. So he experienced that truth for himself using his own psychic powers. Okay? Now, obviously, from a scientific point of view, it's not possible to evaluate that claim. Okay? So, in a sense, we have to take that on faith. But the Buddha did say that we can develop similar abilities ourselves through meditation, and so it's possible to verify that. And it seems that it is also possible to verify teachings on rebirth to some degree using scientific method. Okay, I don't know if it's possible to verify everything about it, but some things through, for example, work of in Stevenson, who did a lot of research into children's memories of their past lives, where you know there might be a particular child who says, "I was born in such and such a village," and they go to that village and the child can find the house and then says, "Oh, here's my mummy and daddy," and runs into the room and then says, "There's my toys," and playing with their toys. And so there are thousands of cases like this. Okay, so this seems to be quite a good evidence for rebirth from a scientific point of view. Now, the specifically Buddhist take on this, which distinguishes the Buddhist teaching from any other teaching of rebirth, okay, is that Buddhism doesn't teach of a soul. Okay? So one of the basic Buddhist doctrines is the teaching of not self or no soul. Okay? And so whereas every other religion teaching on rebirth says that there's some kind of soul which starts in one place and ends up in another place, Buddhism denies that that's an adequate explanation of facts. And instead of talking about a soul, what we talk about in Buddhism is a stream of consciousness. Okay? And so what that means is that there's no entity which travels from one place to the other. What there is a process, okay, an information process, which goes from one to the other. So there's no entity. So the best way of understanding this is through the simile of the fax machine. Right, now this is not a simile that the Buddha himself used, but I think it's a very good one. So when we send a fax, okay, what do? You get a piece of paper, you put it into the fax machine, goes through the fax machine scans it, creates a visual image, converts that visual image into binary code. Okay? Now then that binary code is then transmitted down the telephone line. Yeah? Nothing actually moves down the telephone line, right? But the pattern moves. Yeah? There's no kind of lumps of electricity that actually go from one place to another, but the pattern of energy moves. And it comes to the other fax machine, and the other fax machine converts to get that again to print it out and prints out the new sheet of paper. Now there's not a single atom that is shared in common between the original piece of paper and the one that's copied. Okay? And also it's true that the final piece is not an exact replica of the first piece. Okay, it always looks a bit different, the colour's a bit different, it's maybe got some mistakes in the transmission. But the text on that copy has exactly the same meaning as the original text. Okay, so meaning is preserved. Yeah, even though the letters might not be as clear on the copy, but you can still read it. Yeah, so this is a very good simile for rebirth. Now, if we take that simile into, if we look at it from a soul theory. Okay, soul theory says that when you put the fax machine, put the fax into the fax machine, living inside the fax machine is a little man the size of your thumb. Okay. And he sits there and reads the fax machine, memorizes it, right, and then runs very, very fast down the telephone line to get to the other end. And when he gets to the other end, he gets a pen, which is the same color as the original one, and then writes out the message again on the piece of paper, and then sort of sends it through. That's a soul theory. Yeah? Okay. Whereas the Buddhist theory is the theory that there is a transfer of information. And that, that transfer of information means transfer of things like memories, karma, character, like what's your personality traits. So personality traits is really just patterns of behavior. Yeah. Okay. So all of these things are encoded in a pattern which we can understand as an energy pattern, okay? And that is transmitted or is transferred. It's an energy pattern, but there's no physical thing which moves from one to the other. Okay? This is for this idea of ego. Sorry? What type of Buddhism do I study? Well, kind of Buddhist Buddhism? Well, I guess the school which I theoretically belong to is called Theravada, but I don't really think about Theravada very much. As like a hobby? Yeah. Sorry? No. Definitely not. Yeah, yeah. This is just a silly political doctrine. This has got nothing to do with either real Buddhism or real Hinduism. Sure. And you know, if you want to look at Buddhism and Hinduism, then of course there are many genuine and important things that they have in common. There are also genuine and important things that they have that are different, okay? Like any religion. And so it's quite possible and I think very useful and very beneficial to explore those similarities and differences, okay? But it's also important when we consider that this whole idea of Vishnu being an incarnation of the Buddha, this is nothing, there's not a single Buddhist who's ever held this idea, okay? This is purely and simply a political construct that's been invented by certain Hindus in order to subsume Buddhism under the banner of Hinduism.
Bon religion is
another kind of thing. Bon religion is like the kind of the native shamanistic religion in Tibet. So like all cultures, they had their own indigenous religious traditions before Buddhism arrived, okay? And so the Tibetan indigenous religion was what we call Bon, which shared a lot in common, sort of shamanistic magical practices. So when Buddhism came, then there's a kind of interplay between the two of them, as there always is. Yeah?
You mentioned earlier that
Ajahn Chah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Don't relate my question.
Sorry.
Does that mean that I am broken in one place in the perfect head?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, we are all broken. Yeah. Deal with it. Yeah. It's not that you're preferring to be broken. It's just that you can feel that. You know? That's what you feel. If you go and sit in a quiet corner and just look inside, you feel that there's just something which is not whole. Yeah? That's not a doctrine or anything, that's just an experience. Is enlightenment fixing yourself? No. No. Part of the path is fixing yourself, okay? And so the way to enlightenment is fixing yourself. And the most fixed and whole and healthy that you'll ever be is in a deep state of samadhi. Yeah? So the state of what we call jhana or something like that. And that's a state of like perfect mental health and equipoise. And, you know, during that particular state or that particular time, there's no kind of affliction or suffering at all. But it's still only temporary. Yeah? So enlightenment is stepping outside of all of those things. But stepping outside of those dualities of being fixed or broken.
Yes.
So what, sir?
Buddhism is about duality.
Buddhism is about duality. I would disagree with that. Why do you say Buddhism is about duality?
Because saying the bad is so bad, you need to have a bad one.
Maybe. I mean, it could maybe, but I don't quite understand why that's about, why that's got to do with duality.
I think it's about just trying to be English. You have a sense of duality, and you
have a sense. That's true, yeah, sure. You have to understand, yeah.
So that concept of self, like I have myself, I think of me as separate from other people.
Uh-huh.
One thing which is getting away from beliefs and philosophy in general is the idea that I would have to advocate or aspire to losing my sense of self,
right,
joining the other universal consciousness.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how accurate that is, but like having a self and then
I mean, one thing to remember with these concepts is that they are, you know, when we're talking about them, that they are just concepts. And that we don't want to grasp these things as being absolutes, okay? So one of the things that the Buddha was against was the sort of the reifying. You know what reifying means? Reifying means to make something too concrete, to set them in stone. Okay? So he's always trying to deconstruct them. So on the one hand, he would teach that you should develop yourself. Okay? So an enlightened being, one of the words used for an enlightened being in Buddhism is Bhavitattva, which means somebody who has a developed self. Okay? And on the other hand, he also says you've got to realize not self. Yeah? So this is if you take up either of those two extremes, either of those two things by themselves, then you get in trouble. But when you look at them as a balanced pair, that actually, it actually makes sense. So one of the things that means is that, and there's a very good saying was one of, by one of the Thai forest masters, Ajahn Lee, who said that if you want to know suffering, you have to, first of all, you have to know happiness. And if you want to know impermanence, first of all, you have to know permanence. And if you want to know not self, first of all, you have to know the self. Yeah? So this is very, very important. So in the context of the self, we have, in a sense, we have like a psychological self. Yeah. So this is when we say we have a psychological self, that means that we feel whole. We feel like a centered person. We know who we are. We're not full of doubts and all of these kinds of things. So we have the kind of that sense of self. Okay. But then we have what we call a metaphysical self, or you could call a metaphysical self, which is some kind of entity which then reifies that feeling and says that thing which I'm now feeling is then going to be permanent and is going to last forever. Yeah? And so that's the point at which Buddhism would stop. Okay? So we can still build up that psychological self in the sense of becoming a whole, balanced, centered, grounded, happy person. Yeah? That's not a problem. In fact, that's an essential part of the path. Yeah? But we don't take that next step of saying that thing that we see now is going to last forever.
Yeah? Kind of like your analogy of the metaphor of the fat.
Uh-huh.
You make the fat of the fat.
Yeah. Something like that, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So you can't, so it doesn't, again, it's this idea of reifying, turning something into something very solid, making it eternal. Yeah.
What is the definition of God in Buddhism?
Definition of God? Well, God, well, there's different ways of looking at it. There's Buddhism, if you look at Buddhist cosmology, okay, has a belief in many different kinds of beings who are living in many different kinds of planes and dimensions and things like that, okay? Now, if you look at how those cosmological systems are put together, then it's clear that they are they largely reflect the kind of beliefs that were current around the time of the Buddha's life. Okay, and so he kind of accepted those beliefs partially. Okay, but it's as if he kind of put quotation marks around everything. Okay, so he said, "You don't take it too seriously." Yeah, and so there you can believe in gods who are perhaps very happy or very long lasting and so on, but that they're not necessarily perfectly happy. They don't necessarily live forever. They might live for a very long time, but they don't live forever. So they're limited. But what we don't have in Buddhism is this kind of limitless idea of God, which is a creator of the universe who lives forever and is all powerful, okay, and all knowing. Okay? That kind of God, Buddhism says, it doesn't exist. Yeah?
I read on the book that there was one day this monk was asking Buddha who was the creator of the universe, and then the Buddha gave an answer, and after that this monk thought that he can't answer it, so he got enlightened, so he went somewhere away. After that, disciple Ananda came along and said, "Why don't you answer this question, Lord Buddha?" And the Buddha said that even there is a creator, or there is no creator, it's not going to make him happy. Like, whatever the answer will be about that topic, it's not like a core suffering of himself. For the Buddhism, it's what they're doing in Buddhism is to get rid of your suffering as a person. It's like to make yourself happy. But knowing things like, oh, who created the world, is the world expanding or shrinking, what's the end of the world like, it's totally out of like the curriculum. Or if it's here, what does that mean to you? Will you be happy forever? No, it won't. If no, then you'll be happy forever? No. So it's like completely, it's not, I think that Buddhism is not about God or like who created anything. It's about trying to find yourself how to make yourself happy from something.
Following up your comment, I'm just wondering whether the ultimate goal of Buddhism is it to achieve happiness? Because I think the desire to achieve happiness is also a kind of attachment. For example, if you want to be happy but you can't, then you're also suffering. So is it like the ultimate goal of Buddhism is to achieve nirvana, which is the usual state of mind?
Yeah.
Neither happy nor sad, instead of just happy.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that the goal of Buddhism is not to achieve kind of a happy state of mind. Okay? As I said before, that's part of the path of Buddhism. Okay? It's not, and we don't practice in that way out of a sense of attachment to those happy states of mind. So we practice because we recognize with wisdom that's healthy and it's actually wholesome and it leads towards good for ourselves and for others. Okay? So that's the kind of motivation. As far as nirvana is concerned, then that's obviously a very subtle matter. It's very deep and very hard to talk about. But certainly you're quite right, it's not a happy state of mind. In fact, it's not any state of mind at all, because all states of mind are impermanent. Okay, so nirvana is not a state of mind. It's a lot easier to say what nirvana is not than to say what it is. As soon as you start saying what it is, you start to get into trouble. Yeah.
What first attracted you to Buddhism, and at what point did you decide to convert? Like, was there an instance where that inspired you, or what was that like?
Well, I was originally attracted to Buddhism because I was in Thailand, and the Buddhist temple was the cheapest place to stay. So that was my original attraction, and so I went along, and these people said, "Oh, they do this retreat at this temple." So I went along, and they did a 26-day intensive meditation retreat. So you're practicing meditation 14 hours a day. So this is my introduction to Buddhism, right? And 14 hours a day meditation, and then you get to the end of it, and then they decided to they kind of speed it up a bit. Okay, so you don't sleep, you give up on sleep. So you just meditate all day for about 4 days. And so that retreat, I learned a lot about the First Noble Truth of suffering. Yeah. So I guess at the end of that, I mean, what I saw was something which I hadn't imagined or even thought of as being possible. I saw this kind of the ability through meditation to be able to literally change your own consciousness. Okay. To change not what you know, but to change how you know. Okay? And it was the first time that I still remember like just walking into a monastery and then just looking around and then realizing everything's completely different. And just seeing the trees and the leaves on the trees and the chickens wandering around, you can actually see now for the first time. And just realizing that there's this clarity. It's as if you've been wandering around your whole life in a fog with a of looking it through an out-of-focus lens held by a shaky camera operator, you know? And then finally someone's cleaned the lens, they put it in focus and they're holding it still and you're looking, you actually see. And so this is when I realized that there was something about the truths that were being opened up that I really needed to explore. And it really answered for me questions which I didn't really know that I was asking. So if you'd asked me beforehand, you said, are you on a spiritual quest for the meaning of life or something, I said, no, I don't give a difference, I'm just hanging around in time and playing the guitar, you know. But underneath, that was what I was doing. I didn't really realise that, you know? And so after that I just wanted to keep on going and just try and take it deeper. Sorry? Jhana? Yeah, I don't think that was a slightly different kind of experience. But it was certainly an experience of clarity and mindfulness and those kinds of things. The death of what has? Yeah, Kendra. Because that's when you know often you can start to reflect very deeply, yeah. Instead of driven into a place where you can't distract yourself with triviality anymore. So yeah. First one would be, have you ever taken psychiatric medication? And that'll get rid of more than half of the applicants. look, I mean, I guess. You would try to. I mean, somehow you want to know. You want to know some basic things like their background, meditation experience, understanding Buddhism. Have they done retreats before? Which particular teachers are they involved with, and so on. But you can't really know those. I don't place too much stress on that, because I don't think you can really know. What I've noticed is that you tend to people who come to the monastery, often those ones who maybe express those kinds of things in a very forceful or powerful way are the ones that are the most insecure, and so that they feel the need to say, oh yeah, I'm really determined, I'm really going to go for it, this is it, I'm going to, okay? Whereas the ones who just sort of come quietly and just stay there are the ones who actually have the deep sincerity inside them. Right? So what we do in our monastery is if people are interested, then basically I just say, well, come and stay and see how it goes. And so then you just sort of watch them over a long period of time, get to know people over a long period of time, rather than trying to work it out by our own perception. The back there? What if you have?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay, but it's just something that we'd like to know about. And it's not. I mean, it's not. I mean, we laugh about it, but it's actually very common, and especially in a Western culture, ordaining is not something which is culturally encouraged and supported. So people who want to come to ordain are usually pretty out there. You know, you have to have some pretty extreme experiences before you're going to show up in a monastery and say, I'm going to give up everything and come and ordain. Yeah? So quite a substantial number of them have come from very difficult backgrounds, maybe family breakups or abusive relationships or whatever it might be. And a reasonable percentage have psychological issues of one sort or another. So we just want to know about that. It doesn't necessarily determine anything, but it just, we want to be informed.
Actually, at modern Thailand now, to actually take in, to ordain, you have to actually take a psychiatric test and health check, and if you are in debt or not, as well. No, I'm serious, because I did it when I went to. No, when I ordained like three years ago, I did it. It's because that there's a lot of Thai criminals that want to like stay in the temple and then just like get money or like the offering and stuff. So what happened is that people need to have a health check. So I have to tell them I don't have any AIDS, I do not any diseases or anything. I have to show them a bank account, you know, like I have enough money, but you know, I'm not gonna use them and everything like that.
Oh,
sorry.
No, that's good. Okay, so I have one more question, and we'll get kicked out.
Is past life remembering past life everything? Do you expect that?
No.
No.
It's quite individual, and some people, you know, it's not even part of what we consider to be enlightenment. So somebody can be fully enlightened and not be able to recollect their past lives at all. So it's an ability which some people may have. And the important thing to do with that is that, you know, the problem is that the problem is interpretation, because it's, you know, it's very common that people can have various experiences in your meditation and maybe feel very profound or whatever, but actually what does it mean? And so if you have any experience that you think may be like that, then what you should try to do, if you can, is to try to verify the experience later on, which sometimes you can do and sometimes you can't, depends on the circumstances. Yeah, and so but it's not. It seems it's quite common that people. It seems that people get reborn in a similar kind of environment as their previous life, which makes sense. It's according to your attachments. So they get born maybe in the same family or within the same area, and so on and so forth. And so there seems to be a reasonable number of cases where people are actually able to investigate and look at the events that they've recollected and then be able to confirm whether that happened or not. But always with these things in a meditation, remember that's a really crucial thing: is inquiry. Yeah? Not just getting attached to any kind of experience you might have, but inquiring. Ask if you think you're enlightened, don't believe it. Right? You inquire. You say, "What's this? If I think I've got rid of defilements, okay, where are my defilements?" You look in there, where are they? Yeah? And so keep on inquiring. Okay. So I think we've been kicked out now.
Thank you. I just want to make a quick announcement of our activities. Coming Sunday, we have all picnic, which is orientation week picnic. So, sorry, orientation picnic. And Anne is the coordinator, one of the coordinators, and he will tell you what's happening.
Good evening, everyone. Sorry for not so late. We're having an all picnic on Sunday, so really it's an occasion for us to everyone that we have, the newbies and oldies, mingle around. It's just for a good chance for everyone who has interest in tradition
which I had experienced, and just to come for a time. If you've been in here, if you just want to share experience, or just want to have lots of food, feel free. We are having the opening at Fujiki, it starts at around 10. And if you're living with us, you're meeting at the ground floor square house. So that's just across from ground house. We're meeting at 9 today, and we're going to head there by bus. Alternatively, you can just go there by yourself. It will run from about 10 to about 2:30. Lots of games, lots of food. Also, this year especially, we have Falcon Asamai, who's one of our patrons. He's coming as well. So, if you'd like to talk to him, too. Hope to see you there.
Thank you. Okay, next activity, we have lunchtime meditation. The coordinator is Shin. Thank you, Shin.
Hello everyone. I don't teach meditation, but it's just sort of a sharing experience that just coming together in a short period of time of 1 hour on Tuesdays or Thursdays, whichever time fits your timetable, and it's just sort of a learning and exploring experience. I hope you guys can come with me. Thank you.
And every Thursday, we also have Chinese Dharma Talk. It's in Chinese for sure. But for you who are interested, don't worry. We have some people delegated to translate to you. So feel free to come. It's at Square House, level 3, the lodge, and it's at the same time, 7 to 9, but Thursday. So the contact number is over there, and the coordinator is Zhang Yi. Okay, you can.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. We have heard about the stories of the film story of the Last Buddha, and now 2,500 years later, we look around us and we see different traditions. So, if the teaching comes from a common source, then why and how do different traditions come about? What happened between the 2,500 years? And are there any differences between the traditions? So, if any of my questions interest you, please do come along. And if you're afraid of the language barrier, yes, we have translated for you, and we'll do our best. So the time is 7 to 9 at the same time, and the venue is at the lodge square house. If any more questions, please contact me. Thank you.
Last but not least, in August we had AGM, and we had delegated the new exco term, and our new president was Linda.
Hello everyone, thank you all for coming here tonight. My name is Ming, and I'm the president of Unibus for this term. Sorry for taking up a few more minutes of your time, I know it's way past 9 o'clock, but I just quickly introduce my new exco term. We are the faces of Unibus, and so we are the people running activities. If you've got any queries, any questions, anything at all, just approach us. Okay. So once again, my name is Ming, and I'm the president of Unibus. Okay, and I'll just get my external vice president. Okay, she's let her do the talking.
Okay, you can tell me what you need. I'm Mandy. I'm the external vice president.
Basically,
she
assists me and does my laundry. Yeah, but she'll be assisting me and running. Besides doing my dry cleaning, she also does my licensing with the
cleaners, dishwashing.
Just to tell you so we don't confuse you with our internal vice president. Okay.
I'm Kai Yi, I'm internal vice president, and I'm the person in charge to send weekly emails to everybody. So if you have any feedback, feel free to come back to me. And she take care of the dishwashing, so I have to take care of his children. Which is you guys.
Mandy, is there something to add?
I'm in charge of the publicity team, and I'm currently looking for poster boys and girls. So anyone who is free on Tuesday for an hour, please come and find me. And what you will do is to go around campus to put up posters for weekly Dharma talks.
It's good for diet.
Exercise as well.
Yeah.
Okay, So please approach me if you are interested.
Yeah, just a quick thing is, like, if any of you are not getting any of our weekly emails, you know, she's the one to approach. So the weekly emails keeps you informed about weekly activities, any current events, things like that. Moving on, we have our honorary secretary who is missing. Yeah, Miss Alvin, and his cousin in charge of documenting our meetings and also official liaison. And then we have our secretary, Adeline.
Treasurer.
My bad. Treasurer. Yeah. So Adeline is in charge of our finances. So we also have our general secretary who is Hardy. He's the person in charge of the library. In case you guys don't know, we have a Unibus library and we have a huge collection of both English and Chinese Buddhist related books. But right now we're going through a library revamp. We're trying to reorganize it, make it better. So it will be open after Easter, hopefully. So Hardy is the person. His contact details are also there. So if you're interested in any books, you feel like you want to donate some books, you feel like you want to know more about books, he's the person to contact, alright? And so we have our English Dharma Talk coordinator, Rosie. You've already met her. You know what she does. We've also met Zhang Yi, our Chinese Dharma Talk coordinator, who you already also know what she does. Okay, then yep, then we have our meditation coordinator, Jing, who all also know what she does.
Can I add something? Besides running the meditation sessions, I do organize meditation workshops as well. And this comes maybe on alternate 6 to 8 weeks. And in fact, our next meditation workshop is going to be led by Bande Sidhartho as well on the 5th of April on Saturday morning. But more information will come up closer.
And then we have Anne.
Why do I have to say full
name? Matt, you can step back.
I'm activity director. So what I look after is pretty much the activities each week so that the guys can come together. It's got to be a mixed activities during the weekend each week. Sometimes it's more active, other times more Dharma related. So just mix that up. So you can pick and choose if you want to just come every week if you feel like social activities.
So the purpose of the social activity is sort of like to introduce a bit of, you know, social things. It's not like all hard on Dharma classes week after week, so it's a bit of time to learn Dharma in other ways. Then we have Linus, who's our Sacha editor. So what is Sacha?
Hi everyone, I'm the new Sacha editor. And Sacha is the word Sacha means is truth. And Sacha is a quarterly newsletter, which is about like 24 to 28 pages. Okay. And we have like 4 topics for, well, my term. And the first one was Siddha Metta, which was mainly about like loving kindness. And then the second one, which is gonna be released, is turning towards pain. And the third one will be like memory, dreams, and reality. And articles are all like welcome. So if anyone loves to write or really want to write something, please contact me. Or like after you get such a feedback, they're all welcome. And the last one is having fun. So like, you know, in Buddhist, well, the way happiness is a part of practicing Buddhism. So, well, practicing is not all about suffering, so also having fun. So that was the last one. Alright, if anyone interested in writing any articles, so please contact me.
Last but not least, we have Tina, our annual magazine editor.
And this year, last year's edition is coming out very soon. But for this year's edition, I would need a lot of articles and photos, and anything, if you, any of you are editors or are good at graphic design, then please contact me. And basically, any magazine summarizes the whole year, and we have some quality articles, I think. I love those ones.
So this is the 28th Exco for you guys. Yep, that's all
that we have. Okay, now there are some free books distribution outside. So if you
interested to get to know more about Buddhism, we provide examples and also we have refreshments, so feel free to help yourself. Thank you. Oh. Before that, shall we pay respect to the Buddha?
It's me to go.
Do you have an extra photo?